governor.
Sugelin says an announcement could come in January. And former Madison State Representative Kel DeRoy says she's also considering running.
Politically, there's still a lot of time.
But Roy says if a consensus choice for Democrats begins to emerge by early next year, she'd consider supporting them instead. Back on the streets of Madison, there are diverging views on what the big Democratic field means for the party's chances in 2018. Walker supporter Glenn Menzia of Sussex thinks it won't help them.
Some would call it enthusiasm. Others would call it just a bunch of people wanting to see if they can run for governor. And that's what I would call it.
Carol Morley of Neenah wants anybody but Walker. She's worried the Democratic field is too big and too unknown.
Well, since we're a year out, they should be well known. So that makes me worry a little bit about the fact that maybe the Democratic Party is not out there educating voters.
But progressive voter Doug Cratch of Madison says he's not concerned about the size of the field.
I think it's okay. I think it means to me that there's a lot of people who think that Walker can be beat. I'd be more worried if there were no candidates.
If the candidates who are running now remain in the race, this will be Wisconsin's biggest primary for governor in decades. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
11 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. Packers and Detroit up in Green Bay for Monday Night Football. The Bears had a bye this weekend. NBA, Bucks and Bulls off again tonight. NHL, Blackhawks shut out by Montreal 2-0. The forecast from the National Weather Service, sunny for the morning, cloudy for the afternoon, high of 40. Cloud cover now, but looks like it's breaking up again. 33 degrees for Racine, 30 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Coming up on today's morning show, a preview of the upcoming nonprofit leadership conference at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Stay with us. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD, and I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very happy to be starting this week of morning shows with Deborah Karp, who has been a guest on the morning show before. She is Community Engagement Director at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and among the many things that she and her office mates do at Parkside is put together from time to time nonprofit leadership conferences in which leaders from various nonprofits throughout that sector gather together to share ideas, to encourage one another, to innovate in terms of new ideas, new ways of doing the important work they do. And Deborah works very hard to bring in very, very compelling speakers to help galvanize everybody for the important work they do. And she's very excited about this year's conference. And actually, via telephone, we have the keynote speaker joining us, whom we will introduce in just a moment. First, Deborah Karp, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks.
Glad to have you here. And we're not too far off from this year's conference, which is coming up on the 14th of November. And just say a word about why this event is put together, the heart and soul of the purpose that it serves.
Well, I think a big part of it is what we hear from our nonprofit organizations is that, you know, they really appreciate the training, but what they really, really appreciate is the opportunity to network and get together, talk with each other. And this is one venue that brings together a wide range of people from a number of different types of nonprofit organizations, giving them a chance to interact with one another, interact with sponsoring organizations and exhibitors who work within the field of nonprofits. And so it's an opportunity for people to feel a little bit of inspiration, a little bit of energized, get out of the office, talk about some important issues, connect with other people who do work that's similar to the work that you're doing, and just kind of like, you know, step away from your desk for a day and think about the future. Really, in this case, this is what our conference is really about, is the future and innovating for the future of the nonprofit sector in this region.
What kind of nonprofits are we talking about that typically are represented by the people who attend this conference?
Well, I would say, you know, a large number of them come from social service agencies, education organizations, economic development. We also get people coming from the arts and cultural organizations, healthcare. I mean, really the gamut of types of organizations. We've worked a lot at Parkside with a lot of social service agencies and organizations that address the needs of vulnerable populations, so we have strong relationships there. But, you know, we get people from all parts of the nonprofit sector, as well as board members and donors of organizations. It isn't just some philanthropic organizations are represented there. It is not just about the staff of the nonprofits. We really broaden it. It's leadership. It could be anybody who's in a leadership role in a nonprofit organization.
And so I guess part of what is sort of the beauty of an event like this is you're not just sitting across the table from someone else who does what you do, but very likely also sitting across the table from people who represent other kinds of nonprofit organizations, and there's a lot to be learned there as well.
Right, absolutely.
Well, I know that you are very, very excited about one of the participants in this year's event who's going to be joining us via telephone. Tell us how you came to be aware of Jim Yu.
Well, Jim Yu, yeah. Actually, I was introduced to Jim Yu through Rodney Prunty, who is the CEO of Racine United Way. And Rodney and his staff attended a conference, a United Way conference up in, I think it was in Green Bay a couple of years ago. And they had participated in this mobile innovations lab. And Rodney was just really excited about it. He thought it was amazing. He really enjoyed the process. And he's the one who told us about it and put us in touch with Jim, who is with United Way Worldwide and is the brainchild behind the Mobile Innovation Lab. And Jim agreed to come to our conference and to get our participants to participate in the process right here in Kenosha.
Fantastic. Well, Jim Yu is, I believe, on the phone line, the Director of Technology Engagement at United Way Worldwide. Jim Yu, are you still there?
Good morning, Greg.
Great.
How are you?
Fine. Good. Thank you for joining us. Happy to be talking with you. First of all, maybe explain a little bit about your overall work at United Way Worldwide as Director of Technology Engagement. I can sort of guess what that means, but I think you can tell us better what that exactly entails.
Thanks, Greg. My role at United Way Worldwide under Technology Engagement is technology plays such an important role in our everyday personal and work life. And there are so many opportunities involved with technology my role is to help United Ways around the world to use technology to achieve our mission, our objectives, our goals. There are so many opportunities with technology that we sometimes lose focus, and we want to be able to maximize our use of technology in a broad spectrum of opportunities, from fundraising to engagement, volunteering to operations. There are efficiencies and opportunities for effectiveness that technology broadly can help United Ways in achieving our mission.
And generally speaking, what kind of technology are we talking about that tends to make the most drastic or dramatic difference?
You know, typically folks will think about how technology might help save some money, speed up our operations and those types of things. And they often don't look at, for example, engagement, getting folks involved with our work on a day-to-day basis, from volunteering to making an impact in looking at the data that might identify sort of those hot spots, those opportunities where we can bring more volunteers to bear on some of the key issues that United Ways focus on in their communities, such as helping students graduate high school on time, being financially, economically, socioeconomically mobile, or increasing access to health care, all the things, access to health care, all the things that we fight for in the communities.
So you go all around the country hosting these things that are called Mobile Innovations Labs. Explain what these events are about and what typically occurs at one of your Mobile Innovations Labs.
Well, these labs are a great opportunity for folks who normally, we in the nonprofit sector, we're so focused on really the work, and there's so much important work going on out there. We often don't seek the time or invest in setting aside this time to be creative, to look at and really focus on the major problems that we're all tackling, because we're so focused on doing the work, we don't set aside time to actually innovate, to creatively think about and problem solve on the very things that we're working on. So the Mobile Innovation Lab is this process where we get all of these folks who are attending the nonprofit conference that's been wonderfully led by Deborah and her steering committee. And we set aside a chunk of time to go through a disciplined process. And part of these process is that we're doing lots of interactive exercises, lots of role-playing, lots of interviewing each other, challenging each other, getting to apply some techniques that, while some great innovations will come out of this process itself, the big bonus here is that they learn some techniques that they can take back to their nonprofit and start to apply. And so it's very fun. There's a whole series of these interactive exercises where folks get to pair off, they get to work by themselves, they get to work with other folks at their table. They interview each other, they learn about and apply empathy, they do brainstorming, we tap their inner child with some arts and crafts to actually build some prototypes, and then we test those ideas, we test those prototypes with each other, get the feedback, refine that prototype, and then we choose a few to showcase to the entire conference. So it's a lot of fun. Deborah talked about how important and how folks really enjoy the networking part of this. Well, this keynote, this Mobile Innovation Lab, really gets people talking to each other. It's not me talking to them all the time. The vast, vast majority of the time is spent working on something together and then testing it out and applying what they learn.
I don't remember if you touched on this yet, but I'm trying to sort out why it's called a Mobile Innovations Lab. Explain the word mobile in the title.
So United, that's a great question. United Way Worldwide invests, and we actually created an on-site innovation lab where folks come in to our offices in Alexandria. And so it's an on-site innovation lab where we have folks coming in from around the country and tackling some innovation challenges.
So this is taking it on the road then?
Yes, exactly. So in the past 18 months, I've put about 1,700 people through a mobile innovation lab versus having folks come to our lab in Alexandria.
Fantastic. My guess is that that lots and lots of people within the nonprofit sector are probably very open to this kind of experience. But I can also imagine certain folks, let's say that they're in the trenches doing really, really hard work and might view this a little skeptically as, fun and games and, you know, this and that. But I have hard work to do. And I think what you're going to say, and I believe you, is that, in fact, although this is probably is pretty fun and pretty enjoyable on a lot of different levels, that it is also designed to yield real, tangible results and to make a very tangible difference in the important work that these people are doing.
That's exactly right, Greg. It's, and the simple question that we need to ask each other is, if we were doing this right with our work, why are we still in the business of helping folks? We're doomed to kind of repeat some of the challenges if we don't look at them in a different way. And the challenges are so great that we have to come up with some of these breakthrough transformational kinds of innovations that will really help us to solve some of these really critical problems in our communities. And a lot of folks think when they hear about this kind of a process, this kind of an event, oh, well, you know, I'm not this creative kind of person. Well, everybody can basically be creative. We're not talking about folks necessarily being creative like an artist who paints or a sculptor or a musician type of thing. You can be creative in how you view the world. You can be creative in how you understand different perspectives and how you can ask questions around a particular problem and to learn more about the people that we're trying to innovate to help type of thing. So there are many, many different ways to tackle this, and we're not talking about all the touchy-feely kinds of things when we interview folks that we're trying to really understand what's at the core of the challenge so that in understanding them, then we can truly innovate. We have some real ammunition to use to, if you pardon the use, to really fuel that will really get the innovative juices going.
Right. Is this a process that at least on some level has occurred even within United Way Worldwide? I mean, is this the kind of thing that even happens within the four walls of United Way? I don't mean people coming from the outside to gain this help, but I mean, does, for instance, United Way Worldwide try to do this kind of thing in terms of innovating the way that you do what you do?
Yeah, we regularly host these labs for our own staff, and we regularly use the lab ourselves during the course of all of the various challenges that we are trying to face at United Way Worldwide.
Hmm. Well, I can well imagine this would be a richly beneficial process for all kinds of different people. Jim Yu, Director of Technology Engagement at United Way Worldwide, we appreciate you joining us today on the morning show. We wish you safe travels to Southeast Wisconsin, and we hope and trust that November 14th is going to be a very rich and rewarding experience for everyone who attends this upcoming nonprofit leadership conference. Thank you for being part of our conversation today.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Take care. We're coming up on 8:30, and this is part one of today's morning show on WGTD. Again, that was Jim Yu, Director of Technology Engagement at United Way Worldwide. Deborah Karp is with us in the studios to talk about a couple of other visitors who are going to be part of the conference on November 14th. I know that you are quite excited about your keynote speaker, who is someone with quite a sense of humor, along with a lot of other gifts. Tell us about this special guest.
Well, our keynote speaker is Vu Lei. He's executive director of Rainier Valley Corporation. But in the nonprofit sector, he's really well-known for his Monday morning blog, which comes every Monday with under the topic, Make Monday Suck a Little Less. And his blog used to be called Nonprofit with Balls, which kind of was a bit provocative. But the idea was is that, you know, we as nonprofit directors, that they've always got a lot of balls in the air that they're trying to juggle.
Right.
And now it's called Nonprofit AF, and anybody can check it out. I just got one in my email this morning. And he takes on a lot of different topics of importance to the nonprofit sector and also the day-to-day drudgery of the work. And he talks about the challenges in that with such creativity and humor and a social justice perspective. That's the lens through which he takes all of it. And very concerned about inclusion and other important issues in our society today. But again, he's really funny, I think people really respond to that warm. And also, he talks about a lot of these universal kinds of things that really you know, issues of, you know, getting the grant proposal in on time and how to tackle like the unreasonable demands of funders and all of these kinds of things. He does a lot of checklists. In fact, what he's doing for our event is talking about five paradigms that he believes needs to be shifted in, for the future of the nonprofit's success in the sector. And so, we're very excited to get somebody of national renown to be as our keynote speaker. We're also really excited. We're going to be doing a panel following that. Vu is going to sit on a panel, and the panel is going to be hosted by Holly McCoy, who is president of the Young Nonprofit Professionals of Milwaukee. And we've got Vu and then several young nonprofit professionals from our area who are going to be talking about how they've been preparing themselves for the sector. Vu and also Paula Pennybaker, who's president and CEO of the YWCA of Southeast Wisconsin, she is going to be on the panel talking about it more from the perspective of how does she mentor younger people to bring them into the sector. And so I think it's going to be very informative for people who attend and relevant to, you know, for people who are both interested in breaking into the sector and building their careers, and also for those of us who've been in the sector for a long time and want to bring people up and help them be prepared for the future, to hand off the baton, as it were. Yeah,
absolutely. Very good idea. I know that you are also pleased that, and this is at least partly related to the innovation lab that that Jim Yu is going to lead, that for some of the earlier applicants to the event, you asked them what some of the specific topics were that they would be most interested in having addressed. I mean, you kind of gave them a long checklist, and they could check off their top choices. And it really looks like some interesting topics have been chosen that really focus on the work of nonprofits and the challenges of nonprofits.
Yeah. We actually gave people 10 choices and allowed them to choose their top three. And interestingly, we put a lot of topics that were issue-based, but and general issue-based kinds of things that nonprofits worked on, things like violence or opioid crisis. But in fact, what we ended up, our top choices ended up being innovating on broadening the awareness in Southeast Wisconsin of the magnitude and importance of the nonprofit sector, building stronger and deeper partnerships with the philanthropic community, so it's fundraising, and dispelling the nonprofit overhead myth. The one topic-based issue that did come up, and we are going to be innovating on that in this lab, is increasing workforce readiness and employability skills, which to me makes a lot of sense because, you know, right now in Racine and Kenosha, we've got the higher expectations and building our future that are focusing on these issues. And I think a lot of the nonprofit's work contributes toward that.
I think that I'm especially intrigued by this notion of the nonprofit overhead myth. Can you just say a quick word about what that what that represents and the kind of problem that it creates?
Well, I think that how it arose was, 20, 30 years ago, we started nonprofits themselves sort of caused the problem. They started promoting what percentage of your contribution goes directly to programming. And, nothing goes to overhead kind of a thing if they could make us that kind of argument. So then they started focusing on what percentage of a nonprofit's budget was going to overhead. Now, every business, it doesn't matter whether it's a nonprofit, for-profit business. I mean, they were aspiring to ridiculous numbers. And the truth is that when you think about a nonprofit, so much of their work is about the people, their staff. I mean, if you're considering that to be overhead, and
right.
at a certain point,
that's the heart and soul of it.
Exactly.
Right. That's the heart and soul
and
of what they do. And that's how they do it. So.
Yeah. So we sort of framed it this way. So now a lot of donors look at it, and that's the way, I don't want to give to that organization because they use 20% of my donation for overhead. It doesn't, it means nothing. And so, but this has become a challenge now for nonprofits because, they want to be transparent in the way they spend their money, and they need to educate the population of that this is how we're spending our money, and it's legitimate
right.
to spend it in this way.
Well, and speaking of legitimate, of course, one does want to give your money to an organization that is working efficiently and spending the money well, not lavishly on jacuzzis or
right.
trips to the Bahamas or whatever.
Yeah.
But that being said, it's as though that perfectly understandable concern has sort of run amok.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and so now this is a case of trying to, in a sense, educate the public and help them approach this legitimate question in a much more sort of nuanced and sensible way.
Right. And of course, there's always those examples of extreme fraud by nonprofit organizations or really high, ridiculous salaries. I mean, those are so rare, and it's so
particularly
unfair.
Around here.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so unfair to paint that brush for the whole sector.
Right.
And paint the whole sector with that brush.
Right.
Yeah.
So I can see how it would be very, very important to explore that and for people from different parts of the nonprofit sector to come at that from their various perspectives and share ideas. So it's going to be a long and wonderful day on the 14th of November when nonprofit representatives gather. That's Tuesday the 14th at the University of Wisconsin Parkside for this year's Nonprofit Leadership Conference. I suspect there are people you want to thank because you can't put together an event this large and significant on your own and not solely with the resources of the University of Wisconsin Parkside.
Absolutely. And we have a wonderful steering committee. I'm not going to name the people on the committee, but both Racine and Kenosha representatives. And we have some amazing sponsorship this year. Our platinum sponsors include CCB Technology, United Way of Racine County, Racine Community Foundation, and the Helen Bader Institute for Nonprofit Management at UW-Milwaukee. And our gold sponsors are Wegner CPAs and Lakeside Curative Services. I'm not going to read all the rest of the sponsors. We also have significant other sponsors at lower levels. Our silver and bronze sponsors include a lot of nonprofit and other community organizations and businesses. And really, we're very grateful for that support because it allowed us to bring in a keynote speaker who otherwise I think we could not have afforded for the Racine-Kenosha region to
right.
have that opportunity.
Yeah,
here.
Somebody of national renown. So so again, this is occurring a week from tomorrow, and people still can make their applications
yes.
in if they like. What do they do if they are intrigued by what they've heard, if they want to find out more information and or apply to attend next week's conference?
Right. You can just go online and UW Parkside Continuing Education, and underneath the Continuing Education, you can click on the conference information. Or you could probably just put Nonprofit Leadership Conference in the search bar from UW Parkside as well. Or if you're a phone call person, you can call 595-3340.
Fantastic. Deborah Karp is Community Engagement Director at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and she has been working tremendously hard to put together this year's Nonprofit Leadership Conference, which again is happening a week from tomorrow, the 14th of November. Deborah, thank you, and best wishes to you and everyone in your hardworking office at UW Parkside. And we hope a lot of people will seek out this marvelous opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Here's part two of today's morning show as we approach 8:40 here on WGTD. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about Twitter. And it scarcely seems possible. It was back in 2006 that a company called Twitter first began business or opened for business. And it seems now like it is such a permanent part of our natural landscape, of our national culture. And yet, as I just said, Twitter has actually not been around all that long, and there are actually plenty of people walking around, and I'm one of them, who aren't yet swept up in the Twitter craze. But there are fewer and fewer of us, of course, as more and more of the world comes to understand Twitter, and not only the fun it represents, but also the very interesting and helpful tool that it can be for someone personally and very much for someone's own business. There is an interesting book called The Twitter Book, out now in a second edition from O'Reilly Publications. And we're going to be speaking today with co-author Sarah Milstein, who is someone who has written about and spoken extensively on the topic of Twitter and life on the web. A very busy speaker, writer, and consultant, co-chair of Web 2.0 Expo, formerly a senior editorial staff member at O'Reilly Publishing, and she helped develop the Missing Manuals, a best-selling series of computer books for people like me who struggle to understand all of this. And I just noticed something in your biography, Sarah Milstein, and we welcome you to the morning show. Tell us about you being the 21st user of Twitter. Does that mean you were really in there on the ground floor?
Yeah, my partner was one of the people who helped build it, and it was made available on the very first day just to friends and family of that team of people. So, yeah, I was on the actual first day.
Wow. I would like to begin in really elementary fashion. I mean, as I mentioned in the introduction, I am not yet a user of Twitter. I'm a user of Facebook, and I know what email is and so on. But I do not use Twitter yet, and I've never even actually really seen it with my own eyes. And I know there are folks listening who probably know even less than I do. So if we can just take a moment or two to try to explain what Twitter sort of looks like. And, I mean, how it functions on the most basic sort of level. And then we'll get very quickly to kind of more sophisticated matters that are addressed in your book.
Sure. So Twitter is a messaging system that lets you send very short messages, 140 characters, which is a sentence or two. And you can send and receive them from your phone, from your laptop, from any device, really. And they go out instantaneously. So it's good for short, fast communication. And it looks a fair amount like the status updates on Facebook. It's a similar kind of a system.
Now, when somebody has a computer, a desktop computer, for instance, where does Twitter appear? Is there a particular box on the screen, or do you have to click on an icon to bring Twitter up? Typically, how does it appear on a computer screen?
Well, the majority of people who use it on a laptop use it through their browser on the Twitter website, which is twitter.com. You can also download programs like TweetDeck, which are standalone programs for using it outside the browser.
Very good. And then when, for instance, it comes across on your phone, does it come across the same way, for instance, like a text message would come across? I mean, is it a similar sort of function, a similar sort of presence on one's phone?
You can set it up so that it works through your text messaging interface. If you have a smartphone, though, there are programs you can use on your phone to send and receive the messages in a more elegant fashion.
Very good. I wonder if you could just say a word about the creation of Twitter, since you are partner with someone who is very much part of the development team. What were they after when they created Twitter, and did they have any notion that it would become the phenomenon that it is?
Well, it was created as a side project at a podcasting company, and I think the company itself didn't really have any idea that it would grow into this, but the guy who had the original vision for it, Jack Dorsey, I don't think he thought, oh, it was going to become this, but I think he thought it had real potential to resonate with people and become something significant.
And that it has. So one of the things I think that is intriguing about this, and we could probably point to other experiences on the web, is that this maybe started out as something that in the minds of many was mostly for just kind of fun and games. Hey, I'm at such and such a movie, you know, blah, 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 versus what it has become for many people, namely an extraordinarily useful tool. How much do you think that was anticipated when Twitter was created?
Well, I first want to suggest that people sharing that information, that they're at the movies or that they're eating breakfast, what they're eating, that is powerful. A lot of people dismiss that as trivial information. But when you get that little snapshot about what's going on in the day of somebody you care about, that can really create a significant small feeling of connection. You don't have to respond, which is one of the nice things about it. It's pretty lightweight. But it lets you get a better sense of what their daily lives are like. And that can be really meaningful over time. So that's originally what it was, and it caught on because people found that alone to be powerful. Since then, people have gone on to use Twitter for other things, including reporting on the ground from big news events and disasters and political protests and so forth, and for sharing links to things that they're reading and watching and listening to. And those uses of Twitter have become significant as well, and very important, and for some people resonate more than the personal updates. But I think all of those uses are equally important and useful.
Right. I think it's said very well by you and your co-author at the beginning of the chapter called Reveal Yourself. You say, although status updates, like, you know, I'm eating a bagel or whatever, may sound mundane, people on Twitter have found that becoming aware of what your friends, family, and colleagues are doing leads to a lightweight but meaningful intimacy. And I think you say that so well, and I could not agree more, that, I mean, there are probably people out there who really are dismissive and insist on dismissing the significance of that, or feel like somehow our connectedness to one another is somehow being watered down, when in fact I think you are suggesting the opposite, and I happen to agree that this is actually building connections that otherwise would not be there, and that has to be positive more than anything.
Yeah, I think one of the things to note about it is that those kinds of personal updates seem to matter a lot for people that you care about, whether it's people you know and you care about their day-to-day or people you want to know. When it's people that you don't particularly care, you're more interested in what the links they're sharing, that stuff seems like a little bit of noise, but it's easy enough to skip for those people. And I think, you know, just being aware of that for yourself, where it matters and where it doesn't, is a good way to dive in.
Right. A question that comes up in the book is, for just about any new user of tweet, I should think of Twitter, is how often to tweet in the course of a day. Explain what your suggestion is, your gentle suggestion, because, of course, it's entirely up to people what they're going to do.
Yeah, there's no right answer. And the thing that's kind of funny is that the people with the most followers and who tend to be most popular tweet a lot more than you would think is acceptable or comfortable. They're tweeting like 20, 30 or more times a day, which is quite a lot. But it turns out that works because most people don't see all of your messages. They just see the ones that you post when they happen to look at Twitter. So they'll see more of you. They're more likely to see you if you tweet more often. But I think, you know, since that is a pretty high volume, a good rule of thumb is tweet like 4 or 5 times a day and sort of feel out what's comfortable for you. And I think it's also worth noting that the majority of people on Twitter don't tweet at all. They just use it for listening and lurking, which is totally not creepy and is totally fine.
So explain the mechanics of when you type a tweet, when you tweet, I guess that's the way you say it, who sees it and by what means do those people see your tweets, read your tweets?
Right.
Or can the whole world read your tweets?
Yeah, well, they can. Tweets are public by default, which is unlike Facebook. It's the main thing that's different, really. Is tweets are public by default. You can make them private, but only a very tiny percentage of people do. But the main way that people see your messages is by subscribing to them, and on Twitter that's called following. So people follow you, and then they receive your messages in their on their own homepage or on their devices, however they've set it up. And you just get an incoming stream of messages from all of the people that you're following as they post them.
So tell us about the kind of, let's call them mistakes, that the average person might make as they begin tweeting. Or maybe some ways in which, some things that the average person might not think about as they start tweeting for the first time.
Well, the big thing on Twitter is that people have to choose to follow you. It's not one of those, it's not like Facebook where you mutually agree and so you follow somebody because you want to be able to send them information. It's not like email where you can blast stuff out and it will land in people's inbox. People have to choose to follow you and they have to choose to read your messages. So the biggest mistake that people make is not being interesting. In order to connect with folks on Twitter, every time you send a tweet, it's really worth thinking about, can I make this funnier or more valuable or more meaningful? And that can be whether you're talking about what you ate for lunch, can you say it in a funny way? It could be talking about the restaurant that you're visiting, can you include a link to it if you really like it so that other people can find it easily? It could be a review about the restaurant, and you can make a comment on it when you post the link to that. But every time you send a tweet, if you pause to think about how to make it more interesting, you do yourself a huge favor in terms of connecting with your followers and potential followers.
Hmm. I think for those of us that don't tweet, one of the things that's hardest to wrap our minds around is the fact that Twitter is about more than just words. Simple letters, 140 characters. But the fact that it ends up being this means by which you can take people to other things, how does that work?
Well, you can simply share URLs to anything through Twitter. And the one tricky part of it is that a lot of URLs are themselves longer than 140 characters. So there are link shortening services like Bitly, and Twitter itself will shrink a link for you down to 20 characters, no matter how long it was, so that you can send around links to really anything.
Which brings to mind the question of why 140 characters? And does that really make sense? I mean, has that ultimately proven to be, I mean, obviously Twitter is incredibly popular, but has that proven to be a good choice?
Yeah, so it was originally chosen because Twitter at first, in its first incarnation, was a text messaging service. It was based, it required text messaging and was based on that system. And text messages are a maximum of 160 characters. So Twitter took 20 of them for your username and gave you the rest to use. It has turned out to be very valuable in that constraints breed creativity, and certainly brevity is good for some kinds of communication. And I think there's times when it's not the right thing. Sometimes you can't write the thing you want to write. Sometimes what you write gets garbled because you were trying to get it into 140 characters. It just didn't really work. But for the most part, it has really generated a medium and a way of communication that resonates deeply with people. And whether it was 140 characters or 150 characters, I don't know that that is meaningful, but the brief constraint, I think, is quite powerful.
Hmm. It's interesting that as we read your book about Twitter, the word spam comes up. And at one point, even the word spammy, S-P-A-M-M-Y, coining an adjective to describe someone who maybe actually composes tweets that might feel like or look like or on some level might actually be spam. How much of a presence of spam or quasi-spam is in Twitter?
Well, like all open social systems, Twitter draws spammers. It is the nature of these kinds of services. It's just ubiquitous across the web. Twitter has it, I would say, under control in that they actually, I think, catch more spammers before they make it to the site, live on the site. But when you see spammers, Twitter gives you tools for blocking them and for reporting them as spammers. And it's not a huge problem. I haven't in a long time heard people complaining about it to the level where it makes them question their use of the service or makes them feel overwhelmed in the way that people sometimes get with their email. It's, you know, I see a spam message a couple times a month, maybe.
We want to make people understand that the Twitter book that we're talking about is a wonderful resource for somebody who knows nothing about Twitter and wants to get started. It starts with the basics and gives all kinds of the most basic sort of information, including a lot of examples of what Twitter looks like on the screen, many, many sample tweets and so on. Eventually, as one reads further into the book, it gets to a more sophisticated level. And in particular, there's some very interesting discussion of how Twitter can be tremendously helpful, beneficial to someone professionally. At one point, you write, you and your co-writer, the biggest opportunity Twitter gives you is the chance to show the personality and humanness behind your organization. I think that's such an important point and somewhat counterintuitive. I think a lot of people would think this electronic thing with 140 characters, that there wouldn't be anything, you know, human about it in a sense. And of course, that really isn't at all the case once you look a little further. In what ways, most important ways, do you see Twitter as a valuable tool for conveying the personality and humanity of an organization?
Well, for businesses, it's unlike most other mediums that you deal with in that it's immediate and it's conversational and it's unmediated. You don't have to go through PR people and journalists. It's a direct channel. I think that the reason that it may seem a little counterintuitive that it's a lot about personality is because many businesses make the mistake of thinking that Twitter is a broadcast channel, a place where you can talk about how great your products are and your sales and things like that. But what smart companies figure out is that Twitter is really a conversation medium, and it's a good place to connect with people who are your customers or potential customers. So if you are, for example, a bike shop, rather than talking about your hours and your sales all the time, what you could talk about are share links to stories about local races and stretching tips and information about new equipment that's coming out that you might not even carry, but that your customers would be interested in because they're interested in cycling. And if you do that about 80% of the time, then 20% of the time you can talk more directly about yourself. But when you're doing that kind of sharing of things that you're passionate about, that you care about, you reveal some of your own personality, and that makes people feel, you know, more connected to, more invested in you. And that turns out to be true for really big companies and for small companies as well.
And what a great benefit that is, in both tangible and intangible ways.
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes there are things that you can tie to the bottom line. You can offer a coupon code that generates a bunch of sales. Or if you're a store, you're tweeting and people come in and tell you about how much they like the tweeting, or they introduce themselves by their Twitter handles. There's some tangible kinds of things. And sometimes it's a little more in the feel-good realm. Or it could even be, you know, it's customer service, and so it's sort of battling back some negative feelings. But all of that is important for businesses, and Twitter gives you some opportunities you didn't have before.
The book, again, is simply The Twitter Book, out in a second edition published by O'Reilly. And one of the co-authors, Sarah Milstein. Sarah Milstein, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I really do appreciate it, and I'm sure our listeners appreciated all of this information as well. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Leah Ingram, who bills herself as the confident spender, And she is the author of a new book called The Complete Guide to Paying for College. On Wednesday, Sylvia Brown, part of the Brown family that helped name Brown University, she has written a book about the long-distinguished